Hey everybody, welcome back to LexBPDCo, where we do deep dives into the legal world. Today we're going to be talking about the Supreme Court case, Members of City Council v. Taxpayers for Vincent.
Great.
It's a fascinating case, really.
Oh, absolutely.
Free speech and the right to put signs up on public property. I mean, who knew that this would even make it to the Supreme Court?
Right.
So that's what we're going to be discussing today, and I'm very excited to unpack all of this with our expert who knows so much about this.
Well, you know, it's a case that kind of sneaks up on you because it seems so simple. But when you really start digging into the implications, it's quite profound.
So tell us what happened. What is this case about?
Well, it all starts in Los Angeles.
Okay.
1979. We've got a city council election going on and a candidate named Roland Vincent.
Go ahead.
And like any good campaign, his supporters are putting up signs trying to drum up support.
Right.
Now, back then, I don't know if they had the internet or what, but one of the ways you got your message out was you put up signs on utility poles.
Right.
You know, those wooden poles everywhere?
That's right.
Well, that's what they did, but there is a problem. LA had this Ordinance Municipal Code 28.04, and it banned all signs on public property, period.
Okay.
No exceptions. So the city starts taking down these signs, over 1,200 of them, in fact, including 48 that were promoting Vincent's campaign.
So that's where the legal battle begins. Mm-hmm. So we have, like, the city trying to maintain, you know, I guess what they would consider a certain aesthetic. And then we have, Mr. Vincent and his supporters saying, hey, wait a minute, you're infringing upon our First Amendment right.
So did this immediately go to the Supreme Court or how did it get there?
Well, not right away. First, the case went to the district court.
Oh.
And the district court, they sided with the city.
Okay.
So they said, yep, the sign ban, that's totally fine. But then things get interesting.
Okay.
The case goes up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and they reverse the decision.
Oh, wow.
They said, hold on, this ordinance, this is unconstitutional.
And, you know, as often happens when you have this kind of split between the lower courts, that's when the Supreme Court says, all right, we got to step in and settle this.
Right.
And that's how it landed in the highest court in the land.
So what were the big legal questions that they had to grapple with? You know, it was one thing to say, well, this is, you know, sort of like a free speech issue, but what were the actual legal issues at play here?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. There were really three key issues they were looking at. First off, did the sign ban violate the First Amendment protection of free speech?
Mm-hmm.
Straight up.
Okay.
Second, was the ordinance overly broad? Was it potentially stifling more speech than it needed to?
Okay.
And thirdly, could the city's interest in aesthetics and safety actually justify restricting this political speech?
So some very weighty questions there. So how did the Supreme Court even begin to sort of tackle this issue? What was the approach they took?
Well, they use a framework called the time, place, and manner doctrine.
Time, place, and manner.
Yeah. It's a way of analyzing whether a law regulating speech is actually constitutional.
Okay.
Basically, it says for a law to be okay, it has to meet certain criteria.
Okay.
So you can't just shut down someone's speech because you don't like it. It's got to be more nuanced than that.
All right, so tell us about those criteria, because that's really important.
All right, so there are three main ones. First, the law has to serve a significant government interest.
Okay.
So like a real reason, not just, well, we don't like the way it looks.
Right.
Second, it has to be narrowly tailored.
Okay.
Which means it can't be so broad that it ends up suppressing a whole bunch of other speech that's protected.
Yep.
It's got to be focused on the specific problem.
Gotcha. So it can't be this sort of like, you know, catch all net.
Exactly.
Okay.
And then the third criteria, this is a big one, it has to leave open, ample, alternative channels of communication.
Okay.
So you can't totally shut someone down just because you don't like how they're expressing themselves. They got to have other ways to get their message out there.
So it's like you can't cut off all avenues of free speech.
Exactly. And in this case, the Supreme Court made a really crucial distinction. They said utility poles, they're not a public forum.
Wait, so what is a public forum? And why does that even matter in this case?
Yeah, good question. So think of a public park, right?
Yeah.
That's a classic public forum, a place where people can gather and express themselves. Utility poles, not so much. They weren't designed for that kind of public assembly and expression. So the city actually has more leeway to regulate what happens on them, including what can be attached to them.
So because utility poles aren't considered this sort of like designated space for free expression, the city has a little bit more power to control what goes on there.
Right.
Okay, so I'm on the edge of my seat here.
Hey.
How did the Supreme Court ultimately rule in this case?
Mm-hmm.
Did they side with the city's desire for, I don't know, a cleaner look? Or did they say, no, the campaign's right to free speech, you know, trumps that?
Well, the core was divided on this one, but a 6-3 majority actually sided with the city of Los Angeles.
Oh, really?
They upheld the sign ban.
Interesting. So the city's desire for a certain aesthetic actually won out. What was the reasoning behind that decision? Why would the Supreme Court allow a city to just ban signs, even ones expressing, you know, political messages?
Yeah, well, Justice Stevens, he wrote the opinion for the majority, and there were several key points that they relied on in their decision.
Okay, so let's hear it. What were those reasons? What made them decide that the city could actually do this?
Well, first off, and this is really important for anyone working with sign laws, the court really emphasized that the Los Angeles ordinance was content neutral.
Content neutral. Okay, what exactly does that mean in this context?
So it means the law applied to all signs. It didn't matter what the message was, political signs, commercial signs, even those lost cat posters you see, everything banned. The city wasn't saying you can say this, but you can't say that.
So no favoritism towards certain viewpoints.
Right, exactly. It was applied across the board.
Okay, that makes sense from a free speech perspective.
Oh.
What else swayed the court's decision?
Well, this might surprise you. They actually accepted visual clutter as a legitimate harm.
That the city had a right to address. In fact, Justice Stevens, he called it a visual assault.
A visual assault. That's pretty strong language. So the court actually acknowledged that aesthetics could be a valid concern for a city.
Yeah, and this is where it gets tricky, right? Because balancing free speech with aesthetic concerns, it's a tough one.
Right.
You know, the court recognized that cities do have this interest in maintaining a certain visual appeal in their, you know, their public spaces.
But doesn't that open the door for cities to potentially restrict all sorts of expression based on just, you know, someone's idea of what looks good? I mean, could they just ban anything they find ugly or offensive?
That's a valid concern. And it's something that Justice Brennan really hammered on in his dissenting opinion, which we'll talk about in a bit. But for the majority in this case, the key was that the Los Angeles ordinance was narrowly tailored.
Okay, narrowly tailored. So how did the court determine if a law is too broad or not? Well, they found that this ban specifically targeted the problem signs on public property without overreaching into other forms of expression. Remember, this wasn't a total ban on signs, just on signs in this particular location.
Okay, so they were looking for a very targeted approach, not just some kind of sweeping ban that would stifle a wide range of speech.
Right, exactly.
Gotcha. Okay, yeah. So what was the final piece of the majority's reasoning?
Well, they also pointed out that people still had other ways to campaign and express their political views. They could hand out flyers, they could put bumper stickers on their cars, or, you know, put signs on private property with the owner's permission.
Right.
So while this specific method of communication was restricted, it wasn't a complete shutdown of their free speech.
So the majority was saying, hey, look, the city isn't totally silencing anyone. There are other ways to get your message out there.
Exactly.
Okay, so it sounds like their argument really hinged on, you know, the law being content neutral, narrowly tailored, and leaving open those alternative channels for expression.
Right.
But as you might imagine, not everyone on the court agreed with this line of reasoning.
Of course not. This is the Supreme Court we're talking about.
Right. So tell us about the dissenting voices in this case. What arguments did they make?
Well, Justice Brennan, along with Justices Marshall and Blackmun, they wrote a pretty fiery dissent.
Okay.
And they had some serious concerns about the majority's logic.
Lay it on us. What were their main points of disagreement?
Well, one of Brennan's main critiques was with this whole idea of using visual clutter as a justification for limiting free speech. He argued that what one person finds visually unappealing, another might not, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Right. He has a point there.
Right. It's too subjective, he said, to base these restrictions on something like that.
Yeah, that's interesting. What else did he find problematic?
He also questioned whether the city had really exhausted all other options before just resorting to a total ban. You know, could they have limited the size or number of signs, maybe required permits or imposed time limits? You know, the dissent felt like they went straight for the most restrictive option without really seriously considering these less drastic alternatives.
So they were saying, hey, maybe there are other ways to address the city's concerns without completely banning this form of political expression.
Exactly.
Okay, and did they bring up anything else?
Yeah, they also raised a really important point about fairness. They argued that a blanket ban like this could disproportionately hurt candidates with limited resources who might rely more heavily on this low-cost signage to get their message out. You know, they might not have the money for fancy billboards or TV ads.
Interesting. So this seemingly simple sign ordinance could actually create kind of an uneven playing field, giving an advantage to wealthier candidates.
That was a major concern of the dissent.
So how did the majority respond to all of these arguments?
Well, they did acknowledge these concerns. You know, they weren't completely dismissive of them, but they emphasized that cities aren't obligated to try every single possible solution to a problem before addressing a specific part of it.
So they were saying, look, we get it, but the city doesn't have to solve every aesthetic issue to deal with this particular one. And while we acknowledge that a sign ban might affect some candidates more than others, we don't think it rises to the level of a constitutional violation.
Right. And they also reiterated that the city does have a legitimate interest in maintaining a certain visual environment, even if those aesthetics are, you know, somewhat subjective.
Right. So this case really highlights that tension that's always there, you know, between allowing for some regulation, but also protecting free speech. Hmm. It's a tricky balance to strike.
Absolutely. And, you know, this case has had a lasting impact on how we understand those rights, particularly when it comes to signs in public spaces.
Uh-huh.
Members of City Council v. Taxpayers for Vincent, this is a landmark case. It gets cited all the time, especially in these cases involving sign ordinances. And it really solidified this idea that these content-neutral regulations on speech can be constitutional.
Okay.
But they have to be very carefully designed.
So if a city wants to regulate signs, they can't just target messages they don't like. It has to be applied across the board.
Exactly. And if a city can back up its aesthetic concerns with solid evidence, courts are more likely to defer to their judgment. So, you know, this case established that cities can regulate speech in public spaces, but it all boils down to the specifics of how they do it. Content neutrality, narrow tailoring. Those are the watchwords.
This case has been really eye-opening. You know, we've gone from these humble campaign signs on utility poles to this much broader exploration of free speech and aesthetics and the lasting impact of one Supreme Court case. It's amazing.
It really shows how a seemingly narrow ruling can have these far-reaching implications and really shape the legal landscape for years to come.
Before we wrap up, I want to give our listeners something practical they can take away from this.
Mm.
What advice would you give to someone facing a situation where their right to express themselves in public is being challenged? What are some key things to keep in mind?
Well, one area where you really see the influence of Vincent is in the regulation of roadside memorials.
You know, those crosses and flowers people put up after accidents.
Exactly. They can be very moving tributes, but they also raise some interesting legal questions.
Yeah, I can see that.
You know, questions about safety, religious displays on public property, and of course, aesthetics.
Right.
Some cities have tried to regulate these memorials, citing Vincent and its recognition of, you know, these aesthetic interests.
Mm-hmm.
But courts have often pushed back, emphasizing that, you know, these memorials are a form of expression, often with deep personal or religious significance.
Right.
And so any regulations have to be content neutral and narrowly tailored, just like with the signs in Vincent.
So a city couldn't just come in and say all roadside memorials are banned. They're too distracting. They'd need a stronger justification than that.
Yeah, exactly. They'd have to show a real compelling reason that goes beyond just visual clutter. Maybe there's evidence that a specific memorial is a safety hazard or it's blocking traffic, but just saying it clashes with the city's aesthetic vision, that wouldn't be enough.
Interesting. So it sounds like Vincent, while upholding the sign ban in that case, actually provided some legal ammunition for those who want to create these memorials.
Mm-hmm.
It's a reminder that even when it comes to aesthetics, the government can't just restrict expression without a really good reason.
Absolutely. And it's not just roadside memorials. Think about protests and demonstrations.
Right.
They often involve signs, banners, even street art, and cities might want to restrict them. You know, they might cite concerns about public safety or disruption.
Right. I can see how a big protest could cause some logistical headaches for a city. But couldn't those concerns about, you know, keeping things orderly, couldn't that be used as an excuse to just shut down protests about issues they don't like?
That's the danger. And that's why Vincent is so important in this context, because courts have consistently held that while cities can regulate the time, place, and manner of protests,
okay,
they can't do it in a way that discriminates based on the message.
So a city couldn't say, okay, you can protest over here, but only if your signs support this particular cause.
Right, exactly. That would be a clear First Amendment violation. And Vincent, with its emphasis on content neutrality, provides a legal basis for challenging those kinds of restrictions.
It seems like this one case has had this ripple effect influencing how cities approach all sorts of issues related to free speech in public spaces.
Huh.
It's like a blueprint for navigating that tricky terrain where expression and regulation collide.
That's a great way to put it. And its impact extends even beyond these specific examples. Vincent has really shaped how we think about the government's role in regulating aesthetics in general. Huh. You know, it sparked all these ongoing debates about whether cities should have the power to dictate what's considered visually appealing and what constitutes blight.
Yeah. That's a tough one. Like we said before, beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
Yeah.
Where do you draw the line between legitimate aesthetic concerns and just straight up censorship?
It's the million-dollar question, and there's no easy answer. But Vincent, even though it ultimately upheld a restriction based on aesthetics, it serves as a cautionary tale. It reminds us that the government's power in this area is not unlimited, and that any restrictions on expression have to be very carefully justified.
So it sounds like the takeaway here is that this case provides a framework for thinking about these issues.
Yeah.
A set of principles that can be applied in all sorts of contexts.
Exactly. And all those legal battles over, you know, signs, memorials, protests, public art installations, even things like architectural styles, they're all influenced by the principles established in members of city council v. taxpayers for Vincent.
This has been a fantastic deep dive. We've gone from those humble campaign signs on utility poles to this much broader exploration of free speech and aesthetics
mm-hmm.
and the lasting impact of this one Supreme Court case.
It really shows how these seemingly small legal battles can have big implications.
Absolutely. So before we wrap up, I want to leave our listeners with something practical they can take away from this. What advice would you give to someone who's facing a situation where their right to express themselves in public is being challenged?
Oh, that's such an important question. I think the first and most important thing is to know your rights. The First Amendment is there to protect a wide range of expression, even if it's controversial or unpopular. Don't be afraid to stand up for your right to speak your mind.
And don't assume that you're automatically in the wrong just because someone in a position of authority says so. Do your research.
Exactly. Look into the specific laws and regulations in your city or town. See how Vincent and other relevant cases have been applied in similar situations. Knowledge is power.
And if you're facing a really serious challenge, don't be afraid to consult with an expert.
Absolutely. There are organizations and attorneys who specialize in First Amendment law. They can help you navigate these complex issues and ensure your rights are protected.
Well, this has been an incredible journey through the legal landscape. A huge thank you to our expert for being our guide today.
It's been my pleasure.
And to all our listeners, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into members of City Council v. Taxpayers for Vincent. We hope you came away with a deeper understanding of this landmark case and its impact on free speech in public spaces.
It's a case that keeps on giving.
It really does. And remember, everyone, even seemingly small legal battles, can have big implications. Understanding your rights and knowing how to advocate for them is crucial. Until next time, keep those legal minds sharp and stay curious.